Hi everybody. I was going to say good morning, and then I realized that it's only morning for some of us. But so I want to first just say thanks to Frank and Susan for inviting me to do this thing, and it should be fun. I've never really done this sort of webinar before, so hopefully it'll be fun for everybody, and we'll have a good time. So I want to just make some very brief sort of introductory remarks. And then I thought about sort of what I think epistemic cognition is about, why it's important, and what I think we can gain from sort of trying to understand it from a situated cognition perspective. And then I thought we would work through some examples that are in that document that that we sent around to try to get through some of the issues that come up, I think, around how you sort of see epistemic cognition and what you can infer about people's beliefs about knowledge and knowing through their activity. So it's interesting to me to hear that so many of you on the webinar today are interested in argumentation and scientific reasoning, because that's the reason that I got interested in epistemic cognition myself. And for me, the big questions about this stuff, is we can ask the question, why should we care as researchers, and particularly as educational researchers, why do we care about people's ideas about knowledge and what it means to know something? And for me, I think the answer to that is that it seems important that people understand for themselves why they think the things that they do, right? Why do they believe the things that they believe? And how can they decide when to trust something? And I think this is particularly important in science education as we think about the ways in which science education does or doesn't prepare people to engage with science in their everyday life. And so it's that set of sort of practical issues that really motivates the way I think about this stuff. And hi, Effie. I'll get to sort of how that kind of basic educational interest influences this situated perspective that I'm trying to sort of work through. But let me first define what I think epistemic cognition is, in case there's some confusion about what that really means. So for me, the phrase epistemic cognition, the earliest use I've heard of that was from Karen Kitchener in an article in 1983 in Human Development, and she sort of argued that that if you wanted to understand how people reason through complex problems in their lives, that you needed to propose essentially that there was a metacognition, right? And so she termed this sort of meta level of metacognition epistemic cognition. And what she was trying to get at is that if you're trying to solve sort of ill-structured problems, then you need to have some ideas about how you're going to tell when you've arrived at an answer, right? So in other words, if we think about, say, a scientific argument, how do you know that you've come up with a good scientific explanation for something if you don't know what counts as a good scientific explanation? So epistemic cognition refers to the sort of thinking that people might engage in to decide for themselves when they know something and when they've sort of come up with a reasonable solution to an ill-structured problem. So if you think about educational research in the disciplines, in particular in math and science, and especially if you think about learning sciences research in these areas, then it's sort of evident that learning scientists have been interested in some of these basic questions really for decades. And in the learning sciences, we've sort of, I think, always tended to take kind of disciplinary perspective, right? So we have coming out of the sort of cognitive science roots of the field, I think, in the learning sciences, always taken seriously that what it means to know science is different than what it means to know math and what it means to know history. Okay, now in contrast, area of research in that comes out of educational psychology, known as personal epistemology, that was sort of started by William Perry's work with Harvard undergraduate students. And that research sort of started with this idea that people had beliefs and maybe even belief systems that were that concerned epistemology, right? So that essentially this notion of personal epistemology was that people develop, in a kind of Piagetian sense, theories about knowledge and knowing that they apply to situations where they're trying to know things, right? And that work historically has not taken a disciplinary perspective at all. And I think lots of people besides myself have critiqued that as a real problem in personal epistemology research, that you can't you don't you aren't necessarily going to get at people's ideas about what it means to know math without looking at how they try to do math, for example. Okay, so if you've if so I wanted to just kind of get that out of the way because of the first part of that paper that you read as preparation for today is a critique of these sort of educational psychology models, and the thrust of that critique is that they haven't historically taken knowledge in the disciplines very seriously in relation to how individual people might come to know things within those disciplines. So what then is a situated perspective? Let me just ask, because I don't want to kind of be too basic here. Maybe people can sort of let me know in the chat how familiar they are with situated cognition as just a general theoretical perspective. I'll wait. Okay, a couple fairly comfortable. Okay. Okay, so a lot of you are really comfortable with it, and some of you are very new. Okay, so let me just, for the new, actually, I'm never sure if my views on situated cognition are the same as anybody else's, so let me sort of tell you what I think of as my view. So for me, the basic kind of, one of the basic underlying premises of situated cognition as it comes out of socio-cultural theory and is related to things like cultural historical activity theory is just the basic idea that cognition is situated in activity. So we can't really decouple how people think from the activities in which they do that thinking, right? So that position really stands in contrast to the kind of typical cognitive idea that people carry around coherent knowledge structures that they apply to the situations that they encounter in the world, right? On the other hand, as it's it, it I believe that it must be the case that there are sort of stable cognitive consequences from people's participation in activity, right? So that means we ought to be able to, if we look at people's activity across a range of settings, then we ought to be able to make some inferences about sort of what they think, right? And I'm not that concerned with trying to delineate the sort of cognitive structures that might be sort of in the mind, but I am interested in understanding sort of what kinds of stable partially generalized ideas people might develop about knowledge and knowing as they try to learn things for themselves, right? So that's so and I think that's so for me, I'm a little uncomfortable talking about epistemic beliefs as things that are really stable because I don't think we actually have a very strong evidentiary base that they are. But I'm also uncomfortable with giving up on the idea that there are things like beliefs that people develop through activity, right? Okay, so let me just pause here and ask you guys for you if you have any questions on any of this preliminary. or comments.
Hi, well, I have a comment on that. Just when you explained that, it just sounded to me like this like basic assumption from like research methodology in psychology that basically you have some latent trait in you about various things, and this shows then in a concrete behavior, in a concrete task. So this seems to me like this very old assumption from psychological research, but maybe I understood it wrong and there's something more to it in your perspective.
I'm not sure that I would think of any. I wouldn't describe what people know or what people think they know as traits of persons. I don't think that that actually is really accurate. So, for example, when we look at, say, developmental research on kids' scientific reasoning, we often talk about kids' capacity to engage in some form of reasoning as if that capacity is independent of the things that they're reasoning about. And I think that that's actually not a good assumption to make, right? This will actually come up a little bit later, I think, in the seminar, that it you ha I think you have to be really careful about generalizing inferences about what people believe or what people can do on the basis of their performance in any particular task that you might watch them do, right? And so I think that the trick, the research effort, is to sort of try to understand how do features of situations affect the thinking that people do, and how, if you look at people's thinking across a range of different kinds of task settings, can you find evidence that there are sort of stable conceptions or beliefs or whatever you want to call them. You know, David Hammer calls them resources, right? Can you find evidence that there are sort of s that these things are stable across particular kinds of settings? So that's all I'm really trying to kind of get at, but I don't think of them in terms of traits.
So, Bill, I wonder, I like Jim G's notion that abstractions, if they exist at all, reside at the end of long chains of situated activity. I wonder if you think that that sort of summarizes. I mean, I take Greenough 98 pretty much for granted in most of my work, and I like, so I, you know, you're preaching to the choir here, but I wonder if that is consistent with the way you think about epistemological beliefs as well.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. I mean, what I think is kind of interesting about this stuff is that for me, I feel like if you take a situated perspective, and in particular if you adopt a sort of a very strong social cultural perspective as say a chat theorist, right? Then I think the issue of well, actually, I guess G. For I guess Dan, I would agree with you that for me, G. I haven't heard that particular quote, but that I think sums it up. I think to the extent that we generalize at all, that those generalizations. Well, I mean, obviously we generalize as humans, but whether or not those generalizations reflect conceptual abstractions, I think is kind of a big empirical problem to solve, right? Okay, so let me pause here because I think.
I was going to draw an analogy to some ways that people have been thinking about comprehension and reading skill. And I always stay away from using the word reading ability because I think ability has with it some trait-like properties that people attribute to it. And so I like to talk about reading skill, but the point in this particular context is really that what you see in the performance of somebody's reading is a function both of the text and of what they bring to the to the situation, but it's also why they're doing it. So the task and their purpose drives a lot of what you'll see in the way of reading behaviors. So they may have a whole repertoire of reading behaviors that you never see because the task isn't really calling for it. And I think it might be useful to think a little bit about that, a little bit about that in terms of this notions about what you see in the way of people's beliefs, how they're manifest in a particular situation may vary depending on the nature of that activity in which they're engaged.
Yeah, so again, thanks, Susan. I think that's a nice example. I mean, particularly as it relates to this notion of sort of epistemic cognition, because I think that one of the things that the situated person, and you know, I don't know, I sort of, in some ways, I sort of feel like many of us, if not most of us in the learning sciences, kind of take a situated perspective for granted by now. I'm not sure that that's true, but I sometimes get that sense. But it's a very different perspective than the way the personal epistemology people have approached this stuff historically. But I think that with respect to, so if we think about a reading task, right, and the goal, so one of the reasons that I like the situated perspective so much is it kind of highlights goals, right, as a big driver in cognition, which is true of cognitive work as well, it frames situated cognition and social cultural theory more generally, to my mind, frame goals as tied not just to persons but to persons in activity, right? So that I find that really useful. Now, the thing is, I think that we're empirically, I'm not sure that we're yet at a point where we understand that well how people's goals might affect the way they appear to think about knowledge, right? So so David Hammer, you know, in his writing on this stuff, and he and I think very similarly about these issues, but in his writing about this stuff, he uses the sort of sociolinguistic idea of framing as a way to sort of think about what people are doing in particular activities. So, you know, when we're in conversation with each other, the people involved in conversation are sort of interpreting the sort of rules of the conversation within a particular frame. It's an idea that comes from Irving Goffman. And so so if we think about that idea as it applies to something like reading, then what we would ask is sort of, what's the frame in which a person is reading a particular text? So what are they trying to do? And then if you thought about, say, somebody reading a science article, right, a popular science article, well, one goal they might have is to evaluate the science in the article, right? So they might actually be trying to decide if they believe the scientific claim, right? But they might also be reading that article for some other purpose, right? So maybe they're trying to decide if they should take zinc to prevent colds, right? And so in that case, they're not necessarily evaluating the truth, the sort of veracity of a claim about whether or not that will work, although that might be a part of it. But they might also just be trying to decide if it feels like something they ought to do, right? And so I think it's hard to, so if you want to understand how people are approaching either the construction or the evaluation of knowledge claims in some particular setting, then you have to sort of try to understand the goals that they might have for doing that, right? And actually the piece by Clark Chan and his colleagues that I put on the reading list from a couple of years ago does a really nice job of sort of articulating how these goals, and he refers to them as epistemic aims, are at least would potentially affect the kind of epistemic cognition that people are engaged in. So let me just again see if there are further comments of this kind of general nature that people want to get into. Okay, so, oh.
Sorry, I clicked just a little late. So the idea of epistemic aims in particular, I know something that I took away from Clark's work is that not only that the character of epistemic aims would determine the sort of the qualities of the epistemic cognition that might appear, but something else he says is that basically in order to class a cognition as epistemic, we would need to establish that there's an epistemic aim. So in your example, if somebody's evaluating the veracity of a scientific claim, that is a kind of, there's a kind of epistemic aim that's involved there that might not be in a different situation. And if this is getting the cart in front of the horse too much, we can wait, but I'm curious as to how or if this is something that you've been dealing with in your own work, basically implicating some behavior as epistemic in nature, the presence of an epistemic aim in order to be able to make sort of more informed inferences about the EC that's going on.
That's a really great question. So, you know, in my own work for a long time, I've essentially been working in contexts where I feel like you can assume that people are pursuing an epistemic aim, although we don't, I try not to take that assumption too seriously, right? But you know, I do tend to assume that if I'm working in a science class where kids are trying to learn some scientific idea, then they are trying to decide if that claim is believable, right? Now, there could be all sorts of other aims that they're pursuing also that aren't epistemic at all, but that's one assumption that we make. But one of the things that my students and I have been doing is trying to think about is trying to test that assumption in particular, but also trying to think about around issues of public engagement with science, which is something that we're becoming more and more interested in, is we think that you can't assume that people are pursuing epistemic aims, right? So one student working with me right now is sort of just at the beginning of a study where she's actually trying to manipulate the epistemic aim that participants might adopt in the reading of a science report, a kind of media report about science. And so in one framing of the task, she asked these high school kids, she says, okay, you're going to read something, and I want you to decide if you think this claim is true. So that seems to be a kind of pretty straightforward epistemic aim. And it's actually one of her example problems is about whether or not zinc fights colds, prevents colds, right? Whether or not zinc causes colds to last shorter. There's some idea that zinc prevents cold cells from reproducing or something. But then a second aim, so a second group of students, she says, okay, I want you to read this and decide if you would take zinc to prevent colds, right? And what she's looking to see is whether or not and then a third framing is she wants them to decide whether or not they think the school district should make students take zinc, right? So our framing is you're either explicitly trying to evaluate the epistemic status of the claim, whether it's true or not, or you're trying to make a decision for yourself, or you're trying to weigh in on a policy decision. And the research question is, will these framings get respondents to pay attention differently to the evidential information and the causal mechanism information that's provided in this text? So we think that it's possible and maybe even likely that in the two conditions where there aren't this explicit epistemic aim, that they just won't pay that much attention to the so-called scientific features of the text, right? And you know, if they do in all conditions, then it might mean that some of our assumptions about epistemic aims might be wrong. So that's one of the things that we're trying to find out. So I'm just responding to Susan's chat comment. In this particular case, we're building the source ourselves so that we can control for that stuff, right? We're not just Yeah, so we're making sure that we sort of construct texts that have all the sort of epistemic features that we want to see. Right, we're not just pulling things out of the news. So this conversation is really interesting, and it's going in a somewhat different direction than I anticipated, and which is great. But it now makes me a little bit worried whether or not the things that I prepared as examples are still going to feel relevant to the group. But maybe we should go ahead and find out. So if everyone can pull up that doc that the LMU folks sent around called EC examples, what I thought we might do is, especially if you're sort of in a room with other people, but even if you're not, you can just do it for yourself. What I thought we could do is, if you look at the first example there, I'd like you to just read that example for yourselves, just, you know, as just individually. It's an example that comes from King and Kitchener's reflective judgment interview. But so if you just read the example, the sort of story about the Egyptians, and don't worry about the interview probes for the moment, but just read that story. And I'd like you to think about, or if you're with a group of people, maybe talk to each other about for a minute, what about that is epistemic? What about that problem or question is epistemic? And then maybe we could sort of share out some ideas about that. So maybe we could take a couple minutes to do that. Ken, it's the document that the LMU people have put links to it a couple different times in the chat. So it's up on Dropbox. If you go, if you follow the link there, you should be able to get it. If you scroll up to the top of the chat window, you should see the link. Okay, any takers? I guess what I'm interested in hearing from people is what do you think that sort of prompt is really about? And if you think about it as a case of epistemic cognition, then what might someone responding to that case? Actually, it probably is easier to do that if we look at the questions that King and Kitchener tend to ask people about this scenario. What might that be getting at that's related to people's views about knowledge and knowing? And what, as Lucy Suchman used to say, what sorts of interactional troubles might pop up in such an interview, right? Can you imagine ways in which that people might answer those questions or respond to that prompt that don't necessarily tell you about their views of knowledge, but might tell you about might reflect something else?
Hi there. I think one of the questions that we raised over here at UIC, we were discussing how Susan was mentioning that right away she was noticing that the fact that historians are the ones that are making claims and generating arguments about whether or not such an event could have occurred, thinking about sort of sources and the interpretations that were made from these sources. I think that was where we thought sort of cognition came into play. But one of the things that it raised for me in thinking about our talk about epistemic cognition is what's the difference between utilizing epistemic criteria and epistemic cognition? Are those two kind of the same things? I mean, I guess I can imagine the people who are sort of arguing back and forth in this situation, might they have the same epistemic criteria, but then are making different interpretations using those same criteria? Or do they have different epistemic epistemologies? And that's what's causing the argument. Does that make sense?
You mean the historians have different epistemologies?
Yeah. Do they have different? Is the argument because they have different epistemologies, or do they have the same epistemologies, but their interpretations of the artifacts or the primary sources are different, and that's what's causing the sort of tension. I don't know if that's a great way of framing it, but just something that came up in my mind.
So just before we sign off here, just to elaborate a little bit, knowing that historians create claims based on the sources that they have, I made the assumption, for example, that they used primary sources. And so a question for me was, well, is the nature of the disagreement because one group of historians had one set of sources and another group of historians was drawing on or giving priority to a different set of sources? And is
So just a quick comment, although, and it would be great to see more hands in the queue. So to me, I think you're raising a really interesting issue, Susan, which in fact I haven't, even though I've sort of looked at this interview a fair number of times, it's never actually popped out at me in the way that it did for you, that like one way to read what you're getting at is that your own interpretation of that scenario actually depends or is at least influenced a lot by the fact that you know a lot about what historians do, right? And you know a lot about what sources do. And so you'd have to, so an analytic question is how do you sort of distinguish between what we might just think of as not as essentially domain knowledge, right? Like I just have relevant knowledge about how history works. And so I'm gonna seem a lot more epistemically sophisticated talking about this problem than if I'm a high school kid who doesn't know anything about it. And so, but that doesn't necessarily tell you anything. That doesn't necessarily mean that the high school kid doesn't think in sophisticated ways about the nature of knowledge. It just means they don't know anything about history, right? So for me, I think that's a bit of a yeah. So again, just to follow up on that chat point, Susan. So I think that I would agree with you, right? And although you know the one of the things that's interesting is that when people learn disciplines, they're very rarely so. You know, Miriam Solomon, who's a science epistemologist, she's a you know studies science the epistemology of science, and she has sort of argued that people are trained to become scientists, they're not trained explicitly in the epistemology of their discipline. They simply learn their discipline, and they sort of appropriate an epistemology of that discipline through doing that work, right? So we don't give people access to this. So for me, the issue is that if you neglect the fact that epistemologies are disciplinary, right? And you show people, whether they're college students or adults or high school students or what have you, you show them these prompts and you run them through these questions, and then you decide that this reflects some general epistemological level. To me, that seems problematic, right? So the name I just cited, actually I can't remember what I just said that I was citing something. Sorry, yeah, here, I'll type it into the chat.
Well, just an analysis that came up here, maybe it's only mine, maybe the others here at LMU should contribute to that as well. So as you said, Bill, it might not reflect the level of the kind of epistemic level as much as more the goal that this person who states that has in mind. And if you go by car if you drive to work and you listen to a weather forecast, well, you could always ask, what is the evidence? Where do they know? But normally you don't do that because that is not your goal, because you don't want to know that in that depth although this is also a kind of scientific reasoning that might be behind that. And maybe we could ask for evidence. What is the evidence? How did they come to evidence in this type of historical science? But maybe this person who states that has simply the goal to summarize in a couple of words what the current discussion in history is about that.
Yeah, again, I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, your German colleague, Rainer Brumme, has written about this idea of the division of cognitive labor, right? That we don't, it's completely inefficient for us at, when we're driving to work to concern ourselves with the evidence for the weather forecast. Like we decide to trust that those people have evidence and that's trustworthy, right? Because if we didn't, we would, like, how could we do anything that we wanted to do, right? And it's even more that it's particularly the case in fields like science. Well, but you know, it's true of history as well, right? That you, if you're not an expert in a field, you know that, right? And so what recourse do you have besides other than to trust? To trust those experts, right? And so for me, the reflective judgment interview is an interesting example of a way to get at epistemic cognition. So on the one hand, there are things behind King and Kitchener's approach that I think are really nice in the sense that they try to get people to, that their reflective judgment interview is actually about looking at how people reason, right? But to my mind, where they run into trouble is that they then use these problems to make very general, to make inferences that people have very general worldviews, right? And that these worldviews actually cohere. And the thing is that their own evidence doesn't actually support their theoretical assumptions, right? So that when King and Kitchener's work is pretty early in the kind of a personal epistemology scene, and they sort of operate from a kind of they're stage theorists, right? So they theorize that people go through a sequence of stages of increasing sophistication of epistemological worldview, and but you know, their own evidence is that people occupy multiple stages at once, right? So it seems to me that it maybe doesn't tell you as much as you'd want to know about how people really think through these things, to just assign them to sort of a particular stage of epistemology, especially when they don't seem to inhabit that stage in every sort of situation. Right. So one of the things that I tried to do in these examples was, just because I wasn't sure what people's background in the topic would be, the first couple of examples are about sort of traditional ways that people have tried to get at epistemic belief, right? And maybe we don't really need to go through all of the examples in a lot of detail, because I think that you're a more knowledgeable audience than I anticipated. But if we think about the sort of second example from that in that document is a very small subset of questions that I pulled out of Marlene Schomer's epistemological beliefs questionnaire. And I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with this. This is probably the single most popular instrument for assessing epistemological belief. It's been used by tons and tons of people over many, many years. It's been modified in different ways. It has interesting psychometric properties in that the questions are designed to load onto particular scales And it's the status of this thing is very interesting, because it's been shown many, many times that it doesn't load on the scales that it's predicted to load on. So there are all kinds of problems with this survey, and yet it actually continues to be one of the most popular instruments for measuring epistemological belief that we have. And so maybe one way to that we can use this that people would find interesting would be to take a look, so that would be page 2 of that document, to take a look at some of those questions. And again, it's a very small sample of the questions, and it's sort of designed, I guess it's probably not designed to show the survey in its best light, but I find that some of those items on there extremely interesting, so again, I'm curious to see what people think about this approach and the particular items, and sort of what this kind of thing can and can't tell you about how people think about epistemic issues. So maybe we can again just take another couple of minutes to look at that. And in the meantime, if the Utah State folks want to, there we go. Okay, good. Well, so I think that's a good question. I mean, but I don't think that it's an issue that's any different for any other kind of sort of cognitive interview, right? So, you know, the reason that we sit down and ask people reflective questions of any sort is because we're trying to get at what we think of as some set of conceptions that they have. And I think that for me, the only difference that coming at this stuff from a situated perspective makes is that you can't take for granted that your interview and their responses are simply a report of some set of conceptions, right? But that you have to treat the interview itself as a social interaction, and you have to sort of understand the interviewer's role in what gets elicited from participants, right? And again, so it comes back to this issue of goals that Frank raised earlier, right? That you, so what you have to try to do, I think, is get some in these interviews, is get some information about what people believe they're doing. So I don't know if that fully answers your question. And also, as far as a time check, when are we supposed
We would normally have 90 minutes, so if we started more or less an hour ago, or 50 minutes, so there would be 40 minutes to go.
So do people, I mean, you guys can just let me know. I mean, are people familiar with this epistemological beliefs questionnaire? And I mean, if you don't want to talk about it, I'm perfectly fine not talking about it.
I don't know if this is an artifact of the questions that you chose, or if this is actually reflective of the questionnaire, but it seems to be looking for two things. You know, it's looking at either basically modernism versus postmodernism, kind of absolute truth versus relative truth. And the other thing it's looking at is, you know, intelligence as a fixed or flexible trait. And I kind of like, I don't know, I just kind of feel like, is there more to it? Are those the only two things that this is trying to measure? Because I feel like there's just more to epistemology than
that. Dan, you can go ahead if you want. I don't need to be the hub through which this conversation flows necessarily. I mean, Brandy, I think it's really perceptive, actually, that you kind of pulled out those two dimensions. Those are two of what Schomer, who's the developer of this survey, proposed out of, I think, originally five and then four dimensions of of epistemology. I'm sort of curious what other people now it. So what you're pulling out is definitely an artifact of the set of questions that I chose. I believe on the original survey there's something like 50 questions, so I didn't want to try to get you guys to look at all of them. But I'm curious to hear what other people sort of noticed about these questions and what they're getting at. I noticed in the chat that the LMU people said there that they'd like to talk.
I didn't realize that was coming to me automatically. It looked like it cut you off. Bill, I just want to say, you know, for me, you're sort of preaching to the choir. I really take for granted the arguments you're making. Particularly, I love your closing sentence about surveys. I just did tons and tons of survey research as a graduate student studying motivation, and much of my work after I was a graduate student was because I had been convinced, I think, by my committee in particular, Susan and John Branchard, everybody really just said, like, you just can't make those kinds of judgments with those surveys. So I guess from my perspective, and I think from a situated perspective in particular, it's just you're preaching to the choir.
So we here at LMU were also thinking about the questionnaire and if a questionnaire would like be the right instrument to assess what we'd like to assess and if there would be better or other ways. We were a bit critical thinking but didn't have enough time to elaborate much about it because the webinar was going on. Yeah, that's always the same problem. As soon as the discussion starts, the host or expert is talking again, and we'd like to listen, of course.
I can add to that. So we were quickly discussing about the more general critique about questionnaires, and so one specific question is, although I share the belief that it's not a good idea to only use questionnaires, but I think it's also it could be seen as a mistake to not use questionnaires at all, even if you want to know something like individual perspectives or goals that can maybe best be analyzed with a questionnaire, in addition to observing participation, in addition to analyzing artifacts. So the question is if questionnaires like the Schommer one couldn't be used in one context and give some indications of the mental state or the emotional state of someone that cannot be well inferred just by observing. I think that is one of the mistakes that the behaviorists already did. I think the combination of asking people, having a subjective perspective and observing, I think that is one solution that seems to be more plausible.
So, you know, Frank, I totally agree, and I don't think that we I certainly don't I don't want to argue that questionnaires or surveys are like just in principle not useful, because I just don't think that for all the reasons that you just discussed. I think they're one means of trying to get at things that you're interested in. I do think that you have to treat them though as their own sort of interactional context, right? Their own form of sort of cultural activity, and so that and you have to try to use that perspective to help you interpret what people are doing on those things. My beef with this particular questionnaire is twofold. One is that it doesn't hold up to psychometric analysis. There've been a bunch of published studies of the sort of psychometric properties of the questionnaire, and it doesn't hold up. So it's badly designed for what it's trying to do. I've always been surprised since learning this that it's still so popular. Like there are at least three sort of published studies that say, look, this particular survey doesn't work. And I think for me, part of the reason that it probably doesn't work is when you look at these items, so like, you know, asking people about whether or not they like movies that have endings, I just don't think that's an epistemological issue, right? I mean, there's lots of reasons that people like movies a certain kind of way. And I think if you look at these questions, some of them are kind of clearly epistemic. I mean, do you believe that scientists can get at ultimate truth? I mean, that's very clearly a question about knowledge, right? But whether or not people who question authority are overconfident, I mean, I just don't actually get what that has to do with knowledge. So I think that's part of the problem with this particular survey. And it's reflective of an issue that Barbara Hofer pointed out about this area of research many years ago, actually, that I think is better now, but I think still kind of the personal epistemology people struggle with, which is that it's reflective of the fact that they historically haven't been clear enough about what they mean by epistemology and what kinds of things count as epistemological and what kinds of things aren't.
So I wanted to make two comments. First, that the dissatisfactions with the kind of general epistemic cognition survey like Schomer's has led Ivar Broughton and Helgi Strømsa and their colleagues to develop epistemic cognition questionnaires for specific subject matter. So if they're doing research on, if they're having people read about climate change, they actually ask them about their epistemic cognition about climate change and the data in climate change. And they find that when you do that, you get much closer to what the kinds of thinking that might, thinking about thinking and thinking about how knowledge is constructed, that might actually govern the way people engage with the documents and evaluate and come to conclusions that are relevant to the task. That's one point. A second point is that, and it's related to sort of needing to be in general with questionnaires as specific as you can be in terms of helping people establish the context against which to interpret the statement. So, for example, most words have one clear meaning. Well, obviously it depends, and not just because I'm a psychologist. It depends what we're talking about, what kind of words, and what context. So I might end up with a bunch of threes right down the middle because I don't have any idea whether I agree or disagree because I'm imagining a range of contexts and I can't really respond to this unless I imagine a context. So it gets back to this notion of situatedness. When you give people a questionnaire, they're going to imagine some situation in which they're going to be on which they're going to base their rating. And when you don't provide enough of a context, you're going to get all sorts of variability based on not just what their epistemology is, even if you could know that in some general sense, but on the context in which they situate it. So in a sense, it comes back to the thing we started with, which is that, you know, everything is happening in a context, including this filling out this type of questionnaire.
I think I had kind of originally wanted to say something that was about like what the first half of Susan got across, which was that, I mean, in spite of the fact that there have been improvements in a lot of the survey instruments that are used out there. So the one that comes to mind for me is Green and Acevedo's questionnaire for their EOC model. They've, I think, really focused on incorporating disciplinary language, but not necessarily subject matter language. So what Susan had talked about in terms of kind of tying questionnaires to a specific problem like climate change, for example, I think would tend to produce very different and potentially more informative results than the prevailing kind of disciplinary language approaches, because I think it's a point that like maybe David Hammer has made in some of his work, which is that like if you take kind of science writ large as your domain that you're asking people about, your certainty about different types of claims could be interpreted differently depending on what the type of claim is. So whether or not the world is round is very different from, for example, a claim about why the dinosaurs have become extinct.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Green, who you just mentioned, Adam, I think is actually he's really smart in a lot of ways about this stuff. But even that particular survey is really not disciplinary in a sense that a learning scientist would recognize, right? Because I don't think you can just put the word math in an item, right, and say that you're really getting it disciplinary cognition, right? It goes back to what Susan was just talking about, that you don't have any idea from that survey what people think of when they think of math, right? And you know, my own thinking on this stuff has been really influenced by just sort of trying to follow the work on Nature of Science, which is essentially about kids' ideas about scientific epistemology in science education. That work has gone on for a really long time, for about 60 years now, and there were very, very sort of cogent critiques by Norm Letterman in the 90s about the surveys that had been developed from the late 50s onward and the kind of assumptions that they make, right? Although even in a lot of that work, there's still a general assumption that you can. That people have sort of coherent worldviews, right? Epistemological worldviews, and that you can, if you just ask them the right set of questions, you can assign them to these positions. And I think that myself and David Hammer and other kinds of people, what we're really doing is rejecting that assumption. I think that you know, I don't believe that people really develop what you could consider coherent worldviews, because that's about science, especially because that's not the way that they encounter science in the world, right? So I think David Hammer's kind of general idea about this is probably a pretty good one. At the same time, I think, and in fact, so the last example in my document, we could skip ahead, it starts on page 4, is a kind of extended bit of conversation out of a piece that David wrote with a student of his, and that was in JLS several years ago, and we can look at that example in two ways. One, I think that it demonstrates the situatedness of this phenomenon, and it also illustrates David's particular approach to trying to get at this stuff, which might be worth getting into in a little bit in our remaining time, because it's related to an issue that Frank was bringing up a few minutes ago, which is the dilemmas of relying simply on observations of activity for making inferences about what the participants in that activity think, right? So there are some things you can learn from that, but there are other things that you can't learn. And so in the paper in the paper of mine that you read for today, you know, I argue that you don't learn enough about what people's goals are just by observing their participation in joint activity, and that without understanding what goals people are pursuing, it's really hard to make inferences about what aspects of epistemic cognition they might be engaged in. So I don't know. We can just sort of continue the conversation that we're having, or if people want to take a few minutes, we can look at that example. It's a little bit more extensive than anything else that I put together for today. So we might need to spend a little bit more time thinking about it.
Bill, I think it would be useful to look at this last example, but I need some framing for it. What were the students doing? What was their task? Because I started to read it and I realized that I didn't know enough.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. That's my fault. I didn't want to just reproduce the whole article. So, what they're doing is these are I think eighth grade students, and they've been studying the rock cycle, and their teacher asked them to fill out a. The teacher asked them to use a worksheet that she's provided to try to summarize their models, essentially, of how the rock cycle works. And so that's what they're doing. And the argument that Rosenberg and Hammer make in the article is that this particular group, so it's I can't remember how many kids are involved, but it's kind of a largest group of six or so kids. And so they go out into the hallway outside of their classroom and they start to have this discussion. And what Rosenberg and Hammer argue is that when they begin their group discussion, that their frame on what they're doing is that they're just trying to fill out a worksheet, right? And then the teacher comes in at around, it's move 25 or something like that. It's sort of after the ellipse. So in my example, what I did was I just pulled out the first bit of this conversation. And then you see there's a line that's just a few ellipses. And then this Miss Phelan is their teacher. And she comes in and makes a suggestion to them about what they should be doing. And Rosenberg and Hammer argue that this reframes the group's epistemic orientation to the activity. So as you look at this example, what you would want to pay attention to is how does the kids talk change sort of epistemically, right? What are they sort of trying to do in the first part of this activity, and then what are they trying to do after the teacher intervenes? Is that enough
Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just want to share some of my observations. So before the teacher came, and I think the kids were focused on what's on the paper, and they are trying to not trying to make sense of these words, but trying to use these words for the sake of using the word for communication. That's one of my observation. And then after the teacher come, I think they were able to focus on the phenomena, the scientific phenomena, not just the words that describe the scientific phenomena. They were able to talk through the whole process, how the rock forms, but rather talking about what form, what type formation it is. Okay.
I mean, some of what I was thinking was similar, but yeah, just that when they start out, they're trying to, you know, they're playing this school game of, we have this vocabulary and we have this worksheet and we need to insert the vocabulary words into the worksheet and figure out which order the teacher wants us to put these vocabulary words in, basically. And that's what they're, you know, that's what they're trying to do. And then when she, you know, like you said, she changes the framing, she pushes them to say, you know, well, what do you already know? You know, what do you already know about this aside from, you know, forget the words, but what do you already know about this? And suddenly they, you know, are able to start thinking about, like she said, the phenomenon and start trying to make sense of it because they're focused more on what they do know rather than trying to rearrange these things that they don't necessarily understand.
So one comment from Munich was that, yeah, we also felt that it got better in the second half, but still they're not really trying to first go back and make definitions of the words. They're what was the basically the suggestion by the teacher to make that, but they don't do that. And also personal comment from me that this problem of just using words, nice sounding words and putting somewhere, I think it's not only a problem of the students, but also in much higher levels of education of people to do that. So I think in that way, this example should be remind all of us that this problem exists on many levels of education, and that we should not only look at that as a problem of students in like middle school.
I think something that maybe jumps out at me here is that, I guess, like my initial reaction is that, okay, the teacher is sort of emphasizing a different procedure, but I'm wondering if really the effect here is more that the students perceive there is a different purpose to the activity after the teacher's move. So as opposed to their purpose being, let's say, demonstrating correct usage of the vocabulary, the purpose is to focus on the coherency of their model. So I guess that was like maybe one potentially non-obvious thing that came out to me.
So in my reading, quick reading of this, the first question I have is, to what extent are these students engaged in inquiry about evidence, in analysis of evidence? It seems to me that they're mainly focused on the task, the aim that they have in mind is to finish an assignment. And they're looking for certain snippets of text that will tell them some kind of a story about how these rocks form. If they are engaging in it, if they were to engage in it as an epistemic activity that is something where they're trying to make a knowledge claim, then they would presumably be looking in the text as a source of evidence, which is perfectly legitimate. So I guess the frontline question is, are they actually engaged in an activity of knowledge production, or are they engaged in an activity of completing an assignment? And then if they are looking at it from a perspective of knowledge production, what kind of evidence are they drawing from?
I just quickly wanted to comment on the last comment, because I think within the second part, the statement number 43 that Bethany makes with the correct cycle, you don't have to really understand what's going on. You just have to like bring them in the correct order. If you look at the timeline, you could do that without understanding nothing that's going on there. There's no further no further understanding in that sentence.
So at LMU, I'm just curious. I'm not sure I understood what to take away from that comment. Are you suggesting that in that turn of talk that Bethany is just doing a kind of a rote sort of timeline, sort of a procedural stepwise thing, or do you think that there's evidence that she's sort of trying to understand what's going on?
Well, actually, it was only my opinion. We didn't discuss about that earlier on, but I think you could neither say it's just the timeline aspect, nor say it's about understanding. You simply don't know from the data you have. And you can't say she understood more just because she could do that sentence. It might be the timeline aspect, but it might also be understanding. You never know.
Yeah, so I think that's a fair point. And we'd probably have to look at also what else they have in the remainder of the article. I didn't sort of try to finish that discussion. Let me let you jump in here, Brandy.
Oh, I was just gonna say, like you said, there's not the full data here, so but just based on what we do have, there's a little, I agree, it could just be that she's, reciting things from rote. I think that there is a little bit of evidence for a slightly better understanding in that section than in the first section, because in the first section, when they're talking about all of these different processes, they're talking about them in very disconnected ways. They're really not, like it says, where did it go? They're just listing processes. An igneous rock forms, weathering occurs. They don't really connect those together with this causes this. And when they say igneous rock forms from magma, okay, that's a causal thing. But then they say, first we have to start with the plates running into each other and the lava going up. And they don't, you know, she's not connecting those things, you know, in any sort of like chain of causal mechanism. Whereas that Bethany's statement does a much better job of saying, this makes this, this causes this to happen, that causes that to happen. And she's connecting them together in a way that they really weren't making connections in the first part. And again, you know, we don't have the full data or anything, but I think that there's, you know, there is some evidence that she might be, you know, thinking in a different way than they were at the beginning.
For me, just we had a one point that I think was not yet mentioned, that was that we don't know much about the kind of the thinking or the reasoning of the individuals. And of course, in your article, you also pointed that maybe the unit of analysis, well, it's not necessarily the individual or should not be the individual, but you might have a couple of individuals who contribute nearly nothing. But on the other hand, Ryan in line 34, he could have a well-developed scientific reasoning and argumentation cognitively that doesn't show up in the discussion. So for me, I think it would be a serious analysis of that of the scientific reasoning that is going on here should include or would include some think aloud or at least retrospective reflection of the individuals, what they experienced while they were listening to the others, or what they were thinking in preparation of their contributions.
Yeah, so I think following up on that, Frank, is this notion that we were talking about. I want to come back to a point we made earlier about needing, in my mind, I coded it as needing convergent measures to have some understanding of whether this is even epistemic cognition. I think it's not clear that they even have an epistemic aim. They're doing school, and the doing of school gets reframed from copying out of the notes they had in a reproductive way to somehow create this model. It says, Mrs. Phelan says, it's not going to be very good if you're going through all your papers and using a lot of words you don't understand. And then she goes back to, so I want to start with what you know, not with what the paper says. And it's very interesting that Johanna then says, well, then we don't know anything, because it's this tension between, you know, well, what all of a sudden the name of the game for school tasks is being changed from reproductive. Well, actually, it could be reproductive if the papers contain a full model. We have to assume that they don't. So two points, and then I'm going to get off so somebody else can speak. One point is that we very much don't have enough information in what we're seeing to really understand whether the students are making any kind of epistemic claim about this cycle or not. And number two, that the importance of looking at what you get in this situation and then thinking about what hypotheses do I now have about where these kids are with respect to epistemic cognition about this particular science domain, and how could I get additional information to allow me to address those hypotheses?
So I think, Susan, that's kind of the big point that I would try to make from this example is that, I actually am pretty willing to grant on my read of this of that paper that the kids aren't engaged in epistemic cognition, at least in relation to what it means to know something at school, right? And that I would also agree with Rosenberg and Hammer that their sort of epistemic frame shifts after the teacher's intervention, right? And in part signaled by Johanna sort of saying, gosh, now we don't know anything, and then Bethany sort of asserting what they do know. But I agree that with you and with Frank that that you and actually really what other folks have said that so for me that what you gain from this analytic approach, right, of analyzing interaction, right? That's what these guys are doing. They're looking at interaction and trying to analyze interaction and draw inferences about essentially what epistemic frames are in play based on how people participate in the activity, right? And so I do think that it sort of suffices to show you at least some aspects of epistemic frames, but it doesn't, as Frank said, it doesn't help you understand necessarily the goals that are being pursued by individual students, and or even necessarily what epistemic ideas they're bringing into play in the interaction, right? And somebody earlier brought up this question of epistemic criteria, and I think that that's one of the things that I think is hard to ascertain from just analyzing interactions, is it's hard to tell what epistemic criteria people are applying to their work. In this case, it seems to be sort of group work, but because I just think that in interaction, in normal conversation, those things don't become visible necessarily. I think it's obvious actually from my paper that I agree with Susan that what we need is convergent means, right? But I do think that this is a nice example to demonstrate the ways in which epistemic cognition is situated, in the sense that you wouldn't argue that these kids believed knowledge took a certain form before Miss Phelan showed up, and then suddenly, just because she reframes the activity, they have different beliefs about knowledge, right? Instead, they're reasoning about the task in one way, and then they reason about the task in a different way. That to me is the main kind of.
So Frank, could you just type into the window how much time we have left? Because I think we're pretty close to the end, and I just want to give people a last. Oh, we still have 10 minutes. Okay.
We have 10 minutes left, or we're 10 minutes over, Frank?
Yes, we are. But I think that's not really a problem. We have time enough, but I think it's a matter of how to wrap it up now. And I think Susan and Bill, if you, if we use another 5 or 10 minutes, I think that's fine.
Well, I don't. So my aim here was mostly to sort of try to make the case that not just that epistemic cognition is situated, but that there are sort of dilemmas of it. If you start from that point, then there are sort of dilemmas about how to study epistemic cognition that are sort of hard to solve, right? And I think that you learn different things about how people might think about what it means to know something through different kinds of analytic approaches. And I think the challenge is to figure out how to kind of combine these approaches in a sort of a convergent way. I mean, I know even in my own work and the work that I'm doing with my students, we find it very difficult to figure out how to do this in even just a single study. And I think one of the challenges for us as a field is to think about how to do sort of convergent studies, if such a thing were sort of feasible.
So Bill, I think that's a great summary. And I think that in view of where we are, I missed the little minus sign, Frank. So minus 10 minutes, not 10 minutes more. Anyway, I want to thank Bill very much for preparing all the materials and leading a very interesting conversation about epistemic cognition and its situated nature. We could take a vote on whether we all agree or not, or we could simply all say thanks to Bill and see you at the next one.
We could also have a quick round where everyone could just give some comments. I just want to say I have one question left, and I will just ask it, and we don't have to discuss it now. One thing that I had in mind when reading the text was there is this research on scientific reasoning from a problem-solving perspective, like David Klar and others. And Bill, you were suggesting focusing more on processes rather than just beliefs residing somewhere in the mind, and I strongly agree with that. But wouldn't these models, like Klar's model of problem solving, if you bring that into a more situated perspective, wouldn't that be an approach that would be worthwhile to pursue in the learning sciences as well? But first, let me thank you very much for the webinar. It was great for me to attend it and to learn a lot.
So my short answer is yes. Right. I think if you brought it into a more situated perspective, I think the short answer would be yes. Thanks again, everybody. I had a really good time. I love talking about this stuff. I'm happy to talk to any of you about it more.
Thank you also from the PhD members of the LMU team. We had some great discussions here, although they were not as long as they could have been. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.